Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Noah Geisel. He serves as Micro-Credentials Program Manager at the University of Colorado Boulder. He founded and coordinates the annual Badge Summit Conference and is a lecturer at the University of Colorado Denver. His background is as a world languages, ed tech, and digital badges consultant and a teacher passionate about helping educators and students make awesome happen. He has 19 years of experience teaching Spanish, English, and technology, and was recognized as a 2013 ACTFL National Teacher of the Year. He is a constant collaborator on Twitter and frequent blogger on Medium.com. As a community organizer and champion of digital badge credentials, he co-founded hashtag Badge Chat and seeks to amplify others' efforts to change the world. He is a learner, sharer, traveler, and a giver of high fives. Noah makes his own buttons, collects ViewMasters, and takes his dog dad duties to Pepper very seriously. Welcome to the podcast, Noah.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. You said that right as Pepper nosed the door open and came to say hi.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today. I've been connected to you for a while. You know, we're both in the Colorado Congress of Foreign Language Teachers. We've both been world language, which we call it now, teachers for a while, and, you know, have a lot in common. So I'm excited to dig in. But the first thing I always ask my guests are, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Ooh, do you know, I love this question and just the whole theme, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be here with you and share. You know, in thinking about this first question, the thing that I was thinking about is that just the discomfort that comes when of being called out and having to own your own stuff. And especially, you know, with everything that's going on today, you know, the top news story today as we're recording this is around, you know, reactions to critical race theory. And it just makes me think of the first time I had a student who, you know, turned to me and said, you know, you are racist, you are sexist. And this is, you know, she had just amazing vocabulary that, you know, I'm still accessing. And this is probably 15 years ago. And I remember at the time, you know, being defensive and thinking, how could she say this? And I am the sponsor of the No Place for Hate Club. I am, you know, I'm a Spanish teacher. Like, I'm here bringing other cultures into the classroom. You know, how can I be the part of the problem here when I'm trying so hard to be the solution? And you know, so that was a moment for me that hurt, and it very much sent me into the trenches. And I think, unfortunately, it sent me into the trenches, you know, facing my bayonet in the wrong direction, you know, that I was looking out, I was looking, you know, out across the field instead of in the mirror, and not realizing that, you know, the problem was not, you know, external. The problem was me, even though I didn't realize it. And so, you know, as far as how getting out, like, that I am still getting out. It is a journey and a process, and it's, you know, kind of realizing just the power of humility. And, you know, that I don't know much, even though I thought I did. And you know, just being a true lifelong learner, not just saying it, but being it, you know, I'm finding kind of the ways to grab, you know, footholds, if you will, to get out of the trenches. I'm feeling, you know, less deep in it than I have at other times in my career. But I've definitely had these multiple moments that, you know, I didn't know it at the time and needed to be called out. And, you know, whether it was in the moment or years later, you know, where I just realized, wow, I was a monster and didn't even know it, you know, which makes me in some ways, you know, just the worst kind of monster and a terrible ally.
Yeah. And I really like how you point that out, just that part about, like, those microaggressions and, you know, some of the things we might say as teachers, that, you know, offend students of color. And, you know, I had a student, a similar situation where a parent was calling me racist about 6 or 7 years ago, and even sent an email to the principal. And I just felt like, you know, why are they saying this? And what could I have said? And, you know, so there's those things that we don't see. And I really embrace that fact that we're, you know, we're all trying to be better now. We're trying to find out more about how we can approach a situation, but you know, you're really being vulnerable in that fact that, you know, you're owning up to mistakes that you've made, right?
And sometimes stuff I don't even know that I've made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, that these are things that our impulses to go to, you know, go to a defensive posture and to make it about us.
Yeah.
And it's not about us, right? That it's about somebody else's struggle for dignity.
Yeah.
Right. And like how I feel about that is not the issue here and doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, that, you know, it took me years and I'm still learning just that, you know, it's a privilege to even be able to have the mistaken notion that it is about me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is even just a, you know, that because I don't have to deal with things that other people have to deal with, you know, I have this luxury of thinking, oh, this is about, you know, the names I'm being called versus the behaviors and systems that I'm, you know, perpetuating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. That's true. You've taught Spanish for quite a while. Just tell me kind of about your transition from teaching Spanish to your current work at UC Denver and the micro-credentialing program.
Yeah, you know, and I think that there's certain things you can never take away from a person. One of them is being a Spanish teacher. Mm-hmm. And so even without a class and students, that is something that I will be till the day I die. And I'm sure that there'll be times again where I do have Spanish classrooms, but you know, about, I want to say 6 years ago, maybe it was 7 years ago, I just was in a position where I had too many full-time jobs, you know, on top of teaching and, you know, the supporting other teachers and the consulting pieces started to feel like it was having just as much, if not more impact, and also was a little more time sensitive. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of was in a position of either choosing to continue to burn out and have zero positive, you know, personal relationships in my life, or kind of choose one or the other for a while. And so I chose the consulting route and was really fortunate that, you know, within a year was able to get the teaching job at UC Denver. So, you know, it's a much lighter load. You know, it's a single class, but it allows me to teach. And I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, just, you know, kind of just a right time, right place nexus on the digital badging work, where it was stuff that, you know, thanks to Twitter, to be honest, you know, I found out about it. I thought it was cool. I was following it and then, you know, started to get involved in conversations. And then locally here in Colorado, met with a mentor of mine who had just started as a chief academic officer in Aurora Public Schools. And, you know, they asked me about, you know, hey, have you heard about this digital badge stuff? I'm like, yeah, that's that stuff I've been doing, blah, blah. But oh, you know, I have some people from the district who might reach out to you in that case, because they're looking into this. And so it's just this amazing time, place, nexus where, you know, they did reach out. We decided it was a good fit. And, you know, actually the person who reached out to me then reached out to me yesterday, kind of funny synchronicity, you know, to do a training with their new team on this stuff. And it's, you know, just a really awesome place of just following inquiry, not knowing where it's going to lead, and, you know, it going not just to an exciting place of, you know, intellectual stimulation, but, you know, just really kind of changed my whole career trajectory over the last 6 years.
Yeah, it's, you know, interesting in the fact that you just took maybe an idea, things that you'd seen on Twitter, and then it took off. You took that risk, right? You realized that you've been working with a lot of different things and you wanted to, you know, maybe branch out, and then that worked. CU Boulder kind of picked up that program. And what does it look like now for students who are working with the micro-credentialing at CU? What kind of things does that entail? Is it for students at a specific college at CU, or is it for all students?
And great questions all around. Yeah. But in some ways it was, you know, the risk part, you know, 5-6 years ago was, I'm going to be a consultant in a thing that doesn't exist. Like I have a made up job, and 6 years later, you know, and I still have a made up job. It's just, you know, it's for an employer, not myself. And, so we are kind of still making it up at CU Boulder. And, it is centralized in the registrar's office. So it is open to all colleges and even units that aren't academic. And so it's not only going to be students who are having the opportunity to earn micro-credentials and participate in these opportunities, but also, you know, staff and faculty. And so, you know, one of the first ones that's rolling out actually that just got approved is a Just and Equitable Teaching micro-credential.
Okay.
It's out of the Center for Teaching and Learning. So there's no credit associated with it, and it's for faculty and TAs. But there's also things for, there's a group of academic advisors that are working on one. There's multiple things that aren't necessarily student facing, but also several that are. I actually just got an email this morning from somebody interested in something with biological anthropology, which is just, I have no idea what that means. And I am so excited to find out and how we can use micro-credential to change the world. And so basically it's an opportunity for us to kind of recognize that there's just narratives missing from the transcript, right? That we have the major, we have the names of the classes, we have the grades. But and what's that? The story that tells is a pretty bland and incomplete story that just doesn't really, you know, it doesn't do a very good job of being meaningful in ways that probably should be meaningful, like, you know, communicating who, you know, a student is as a learner achiever to an employer. And so we're really focused on helping people design micro-credentials with that in mind, that it's not just, you know, going to be something that at the end people get a certificate only now because of digital badges, you know, it's a fancy PDF. We're really focused on what's referred to as the metadata that, you know, in addition to the certificate, people can click on that certificate and see a full description of just what this program is. They can see what was the criteria, like what did somebody have to do? Did they, you know, like let's add this layer of trust to it, that they had to do more than just pay money and show up and successfully exhale shortly after inhaling. And then, you know, the really transformative piece, I think, is because it's digital, we're able to attach evidence. And so it's not just, you know, what is this? How do we, you know, what's the criteria to get it? But also, you know, it's almost sort of doubles as a portfolio, if you will, because we can attach a learning artifact from that learner that somebody can click on and see, you know, a video or a presentation or a Word document, right? Anything you can attach to an email, basically, that is a way to look and say, oh, wow, yeah, they did deserve this. You know, this isn't just because they paid their money.
Yeah, and I think that's really a good opportunity for, you know, as you said, both faculty, staff, and students to show kind of what they're learning through PD, through their coursework. You know, as you said, the transcript doesn't say everything. A resume doesn't say everything. So, you know, that hopefully will be used more throughout universities in the coming years. I wanted to shift a little bit and talk to you about the honor that you received in 2013 of becoming the American Council of Teaching of Foreign Languages Teacher of the Year, and kind of what doors that opened for you?
I mean, the being a Teacher of the Year closes zero doors is something that I've learned. And, you know, I'm going back even before that, I think something that it's really taught me is the importance of being what I call a professional progress bully. Somebody who I know, you know, an amazing educator, mentor, leader in our field, Toni Tyson, you know, I didn't know she knew who I was. And she, you know, just came up to me at a conference and told me, you should nominate yourself for the Colorado, you know, Language Teacher of the Year. And, you know, I was like, you know, I was even less gray then than I am now. And you know, I'm like, am I a little early career for that? Am I, you know, do I deserve this? And, you know, she essentially bullied me
into
throwing my name in the hat. And I will be forever grateful for that. And, you know, that experience, Yeah, I think one of the things that people, I wish more people, we did a better job of helping people wrap their heads around is, mm-hmm. is a lot of times these recognitions are not just pats on the back. You know, yeah. I mean, they are pats on the back and they feel really good. I'm not going to lie to you, but they, you know, it's also, you know, conferring upon somebody a responsibility, and most people take it really seriously. And that is a responsibility to, you know, wear the sash, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. That you are this recognized person in your field, and you could just put the trophy on the wall, or you could, you know, use that in order to, you know, advocate for teachers, for learners, for the mm-hmm. field. And, you know, so that I think that, you know, sometimes you see, especially in social media, people have concerns around, you know, awards or prizes for teachers. I think that, you know, that the something that's missing from that particular take, and I totally get the where they're coming from that take, but I think what they might miss is the value that awards mm-hmm. have it for everyone else, not just the person who's getting it, because those people then, you know, we're, you know, you feel this sense of responsibility, and you're reaching out to legislators. You are not staying quiet, you know, when you see something happening. You're doing a blog post or writing letters or making phone calls and advocating and, you know, looking out for other people who are early career and turn around and being their professional progress bully.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think a challenge, especially after this past 2021 school year, is that a lot of teachers feel like they aren't allowed to believe that they're doing something great. Like there's that, you know, that a lot of teachers don't feel like they're doing enough, right? So like nominating yourself for an award, throwing your hat in the ring, those type of things, or even, you know, feeling like, oh my gosh, somebody thinks I should be nominated. I mean, how can teachers shift from that, like, I'm not good enough attitude to actually being open to receiving an honor or, you know, self-nominating?
And I think it's really about giving yourself permission to have the mm-hmm. audacity to believe in your own awesomeness.
Yeah. I think that's great to, you know, kind of, you know.
It's a safe fail. The worst thing could happen is you are wrong. You are not awesome. But hopefully you're not wrong, you know?
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you know, it's, we can wait around for other people to, you know,
yeah.
to do that. But it's also, you know, I think that there's, you know, hubris and audacity are two, you know, things that can be conflated, but they can also be exclusive of one another. And you know, I think that if you can be audacious and, mm-hmm. you know, humble at the same time. And I think that, you know, me personally, I think that's a good way to do it. You know, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think it works better than combining hubris with audacity. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with being awesome and believing that is true. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, if one of the things that you asked about doors that open, and one of the most important doors that open is because of these, you know, this, you know, moniker that comes after your name of teacher of the year, all of a sudden, mm-hmm. like you feel like you're the same human being, but the words that come out of your mouth might have different weight, right? Like,
yeah.
Man, I wish people would listen to me. I have something to say on this. I'm putting it out in the universe and nobody's listening.
Yeah.
Sometimes people will listen because of this sort of, you know, kind of stamp of approval or you know, trust layer that comes with, you know, a recognition like a teacher of the year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they recognize that later on, because I mean, I have friends who are world language teachers in other states, and they, you know, I told somebody that I was going to have you on the podcast, and you know, she's been with ACFL for a long time, so she remembers you, and you know, that goes a long way, like, you know, for those people who've been in the profession a while. So I wanted to shift and talk a little bit about some of the articles and PD courses you've written. You've mentioned a few. One, to know your place, placemaking, storytelling, and the struggle for human relevance, and productive consumption and the bias against learners as sheeple. So if you can break those down a little bit and kind of what those entail.
Sure. I just, you know, to explain those a little bit, those totally wacky titles, you know, just to play in my own professional development, you know, in consulting endeavors, you know, beyond world languages, beyond digital badge consulting, you know, stuff that I've just been really excited about, you know, mm-hmm. is thinking about things differently. And there's, you know, when I know your place, placemaking, storytelling, the struggle for human relevance is really rooted in you know, most of my research over the last probably 5 years now is around, you know, just what are we going to do in this world of outsourcing automation to, you know, in a growing population to still have ways for people to be, you know, productive, you know, have productive participation in our society. And, you know, what's the role of teaching and learning to hopefully help ensure that, you know, people have successful futures. And so that the placemaking, storytelling, and the struggle for human relevance is really was born out of that. And it's a chance to engage with you know, a group of educators around things that they might not already be thinking about that are, you know, uniquely human, you know, versus things that can be easily automated and things that are, you know, I think also very difficult to automate. And so these sort of opportunities that are right there hidden in plain sight, you know, so that we might have a fighting chance of preparing the students who, you know, like me, are going to end up in jobs that don't exist yet. You know, like nobody, I couldn't major in digital badge consulting, you know, that was, and so, you know, and I, you know, when I was in college, there was no such thing as an app developer, right? Now that there's hundreds of thousands of jobs in that space, right? And so thinking around, you know, what are the things that we don't know the jobs that don't exist yet, but we do know some of the kind of skills, and we know some of the foundational kind of fundamental conditions to play into that. And so how might we, you know, through recognizing those, think around, you know, how that might shape our teaching and learning efforts in order to prepare people for those successful futures. And the other one is a fun one that I've been doing the last maybe 3 years, the productive consumption one. And the bias against learners as sheeple is really just looking at, you know, the when we think about, you know, there's a lot of stuff around student voice out there. There's a lot of stuff about students as producers. And, you know, something that's really kind of scratchy for me is this, you know, pattern we see where production is really saved for the summative steps of the learning process. You know, that you're consuming. And then, you know, at the end, you do this production kind of centered task. And it's an opportunity to really question that conventional wisdom and also, you know, question things like, you know, that we might assume are inherently consumptive tasks and ask ourselves, are they? Like, are we just doing that because that's our background knowledge? You know, is reading inherently, you know, consumption or is there a way to produce while reading as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, I'd like to learn more about just kind of in those thought process that you're talking about there. And, you know, you've got a lot of good talking points.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
So Noah, talk to me a little bit about some ties that you've made to the community as a Spanish teacher. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit of kind of how world language teachers make those ties with the community.
Yeah, and you're talking community, like opportunities to go beyond the four walls of the class and actually, you know, explore meaningfulness and kind of authentic use of the language and culture, right?
Yes, definitely.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's, for me, one of the places where things can just get so real for our learners and, you know, in engaging them, right? That this is not just about finishing worksheets and getting a grade, that this is something you can actually use. And so, you know, I think when we explore opportunities for that, we, you know, one of the most important things that comes from it is the instilling of risk-taking, right? That when I was in college and studied abroad in Madrid and, you know, almost the entire, you know, cohort was going out to O'Brien's every night. You know, that they were not, you know, taking risks. They were not engaging in the language and culture. They were really just kind of studying abroad and partying. And you know, and part of that might have been their motivations, but part of it might have also been just comfort with, you know, people like me who went ahead and went to the cafe and, you know, went up to some old guy with his cafecito and his pastel and said, you know, hola, puedo practicar.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of risk-taking, I think, can really be facilitated by us as instructors and teachers by, you know, fostering opportunities to, You know, I used to have an activity where, you know, the kids didn't know that the restaurants knew they were going to call, but, you know, I would actually have a restaurant say, yeah, if we see your number on caller ID from, we'll answer and talk to them. And, you know, I would have them call and ask, what's the special of the day? And do you have delivery? And, you know, things like that. And it gives them the opportunity to actually use it. And then they're in front of their whole class, they're worried, they're nervous. And then afterwards they get to say, wow, that actually was okay. Like, even though my Spanish wasn't like perfect, they understood what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that there's just, you can't really overstate the value of those sort of authentic opportunities to use the language. And it's really in any language, you know, it's definitely, you know, those of us in Spanish, teaching Spanish language and culture have a little bit of an advantage to, you know, in most places in the United States, but also, you know, and I saw a project that, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of the university, but in the Memphis area in Tennessee, where it was a German professor, and they used their German to go out and to the German expat community and create a, you know, authentic web page of basically the history of how, you know, different people from German backgrounds ended up in the area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what a neat kind of artifact for the community and a legacy piece that allowed them to approach people, use the language and immerse themselves in the culture in a way that had nothing to do with, you know, grammar or, you know, successful completion of a worksheet or something like that.
Yeah. And that authentic use, that's so important. And, you know, like I would always take kids to Le Central, which is, since been closed in Denver, but, you know, just making sure whether they were level one or level four, that they would order their food in French, you know, they would use the language, you know, make sure the wait staff, some of the wait staff didn't know French, so make sure we got wait staff that knew French, right? And having that opportunity wherever you can, right? Whether it's the film festival that's going on, whether it's some type of cultural, you know, relevant activity. And, you know, I think you've also taken students to UNC for World Language Days at some point.
I have actually never taken a part in that, but I know others who have. And I think that's just an amazing opportunity. And there's, you know, we have colleagues who, you know, put blood, sweat, and tears into making sure that event happens. And, you know, I'm just super grateful for all they do. And I think stuff like that is totally perfect. I love your example of Le Central, you know, the film festivals, you know, for whether you're hearing this and you're in, you know, the Denver metro area or beyond, there's the Denver Film Center. You know, they will put together a, you know, program for you and your students of, you know, short films from, you know, your target language and culture. Mm-hmm. And they will even, you know, they've figured out how to do it in a virtual place where they can on demand create a virtual program for you. And they may even be able to reach out and get, you know, directors and actors from some of those films to, wow, you know, do a talk back with you and your students, you know, for no more than the price of the movie tickets. So, you know, don't hesitate to, you know, basically, I think the biggest thing, like you experienced with Le Central, is, you know, when we as teachers are willing to take the risk and just go ahead and ask, you know, magic can happen for our students. You know, the worst thing that's going to happen with our own risk taking is somebody's going to say, yeah, I'm not really interested in helping out. But, you know, the best thing that happens is people say, that's really cool, thanks for asking. Yes. And, you know, that I've had, you know, a lot of Spanish teachers will show, you know, there's a cute Puerto Rican movie called The Election, I think was what it was called. And, you know, super fun little, you know, movie about a high school election. And, you know, I just emailed I looked up the directors. It was, you know, two brothers, and I emailed them and they were like, sure, we'll Zoom with your class. I've had, you know, Grammy award winning artists who've, you know, been guests in the classroom. And, you know, I've had way more guests who just never answered my email or who said no. Right. But for the ones who do, you know, you create this amazing experience. Yeah, there was a Spanish language speaking, you know, PR arm at the Environmental Protection Agency that would do a chat room with my class every Earth Day about, you know, hey, kids, what are you doing to be Verde? You know, these are just amazing opportunities that, you know, we really just have to, you know, ask, you know, put yourself in a position to hear no, and maybe you give somebody else an opportunity to tell you yes.
Yeah, and it's so important, I think, in terms of teaching language and not knowing when our students are necessarily going to be able to visit the target country. You know, they might be able to do some study abroad if they go to a four-year college, but that's not necessarily the case with a lot of students we teach. So giving them those opportunities where they are here where we live, and most major cities have some type of film center or, you know, other cultural opportunities where, you know, the teachers can connect with those businesses. I wanted to talk a little bit about thoughts on how world language teaching might change post-pandemic. We have a lot of things like the veteran teachers versus the newer teachers and some methods that are more coming to in prevalence and kind of, you know, using technology and versus not using technology. I know there's kind of, there's been a shift for a while, but there's a lot of veteran teachers that aren't necessarily comfortable with some of the, I would say, newer methods of the last 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that the starting point says just recognizing whether it's, you know, on the pedagogy or on the educational technology, you know, kind of components, just how far we've come in a really short amount of time, that, you know, there's certain things that used to be, you know, kind of fringe use cases and presentations at state world language teacher conferences that are now, you know, not, hey, here's a way of doing things, but rather, you know, this is the way we do things, you know, that, you know, that things like, I think that in a not too distant future, people aren't really going to talk about blended learning as this thing you could do, you know, blended learning is just what we do. And I think that, you know, we should definitely, it's worthwhile to acknowledge, you know, that as much we can always grow and there's lots of room forward for us to go, but I think we should also really kind of pat ourselves on the back and our colleagues on the back for how far we've come in a really short amount of time, you know, relatively speaking on those fronts. I think that, you know, age is probably not a really great predictor of elasticity or comfort with new things or change. I think that, you know, somebody who's 23 years old, fresh out of college, and, you know, they wanted to become a French teacher because, you know, they just love the way their French teacher did it, might be, you know, more sort of, I guess the word might be traditional, you know, and wedded to old ways than somebody who, you know, is later career, but looking for something new. So, you know, I think that it's, I'd hate to, you know, I'm remiss to think of it in terms of sides anyway, but definitely not in terms of age. I think that, you know, places we've come on the technology though is viewing it as, you know, just this massive assist to the way we do things, your ways of working smarter, not harder. You know, I think that a lot of teachers who maybe were more resistant to using educational technology in the past and had, you know, basically were forced over the last 2 years to go that way because of the pandemic. I think that, you know, one of the things they started to realize is, oh, wow, you know, like I work really hard to, you know, on the, you know, the folder at the front of the room for if you were gone yesterday. And if I use this technology now, like I just create things once and then it's on the student part, right? Where I can all of a sudden use this technology to create opportunities for students to really have agency and own some of that responsibility for their own learning. And I free up all this time for myself to do things, you know, that I'm more excited about than the homework folder. I think that things like formative assessment are places where people are realizing like, oh, this is a really powerful and a huge, you know, time saver for me. And so I think that on the technology side, there's a lot of people who maybe were resistant to it that out of necessity went there and have kind of had this kind of delightful kind of epiphany that, oh, you know, some of these things, maybe I was resistant because I didn't want to be pushed into something I wasn't interested in, but now that I'm there, you know, the view from this side is kind of nice. You know, on the pedagogy side, I think that, you know, that there's a lot of things there that are probably way more in the weeds for people who were language teachers versus people who aren't. I think that, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that absolutism is probably, you know, not where it's at, that's a slippery slope. And I think that especially in when we think not just internally about our own practices, but, you know, our colleagues around us, our department mates, you know, that's using language like you should, you shouldn't, you have to, you can't, you need to, you know, a lot of times, like whatever words come after that are just falling on deaf ears. You know, that's there's not a lot of people who are thrilled with having other people, you know, talk at them in those kinds of ways versus, you know, that feel a lot more like pushing them towards something rather than inviting them with a, you know, an extended hand to help pull. And so, you know, I think that's where I fall on that. And then, you know, I think the one place that I think we've made tremendous gains. And it's just really exciting for where it goes from here is, you know, the notion of looking at world languages from a proficiency lens, that this is stuff that, you know, even just 5 and 6 and 7 years ago was still very, you know, kind of cutting edge, that now, you know, seems to be really more the way people are approaching things of, you know, what does Spanish 1 or Spanish 2 or Spanish 3 mean, you know, from school to school, city to city, much less, you know, just room 211 to room 212. It can have wildly different means. And, you know, we are really lucky in our content area to have these, you know, really well thought out experts, you know, working on these proficiency levels, complete with can-do statements, so that in a, you know, just really accessible, you know, and relatively objective way, you know, we have these look fors of what can somebody do, and based off of what they can do, you know, helping them understand where they are on the continuum of proficiency. And I think that that's really powerful, you know, for learners. I think it's really powerful for teachers. I think it's really powerful for connecting learners with opportunities where they'll be able to use their language and cultural skills in the real world.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that'll continue to evolve since, you know, I've been in the field for about 21 years and I just, you know, the ACFL proficiency guidelines, you know, they come out with, you know, like you say, about every 5 or 6 years, they revise them. And, you know, I think, you know, if, as a school, if there is some type of a, I think, test to test into a level, right, a proficiency test, because as you're saying, you know, there is discrepancy in the same building sometimes, right, about what a level should look like. And, you know, you're having kids coming from the middle school into level two, or you're having kids that took 2 years in another state and they're going into level three, right? And that's kind of, that was all, when I was in the classroom, that was often my pet peeve, is like, yeah, you're in level three, but did you learn this? You know, so kind of more schools, using those can-do statements, proficiency guidelines, kind of having more of a streamlined process, right?
Yeah, I think it helps everybody involved when we have this sort of, you know, I guess at the end of the day, they can serve as meaning-making vehicles that help us, you know, kind of have apples to apples. And, you know, I also think that it helps us think about things, not just from how we are served by language educators, but how our learners are served. And, you know, if we have a student who's, you know, placed based off of just, well, you did really well in middle school, so you skipped to level two in high school, you know, and they are, you know, it's a challenge for which they're not ready, then, you know, we haven't done them a service. They're going to have a bad experience. And on the flip side, you know, maybe they come in and because of their middle school program, you know, actually maybe level two is not where they belong. Maybe it's level four. And just because that's not the way we do things, you know, maybe all of a sudden we create a really bad experience for that learner, such that, you know, somebody who should have been going on to be an AP and, you know, maybe even taking more than one language is instead saying, you know what, when it comes to my elective credits, I'm really going to focus on, you know, weightlifting and creative writing. And, you know, through our, you know, kind of rigidity and this is how we do things, we might be, you know, unfortunately getting in the way of, you know, creating more, you know, multilingual people in this world.
And I think that's also, you know, a lot of those students lose that opportunity, or, you know, they discover languages later in life or sometime in college. But yeah, I think I would hope going into, you know, the next 20 years, like looking back on the 20 years, that more students are able to keep with the language, or, you know, able to, I would just say, retain, you know, and just have more of an interest. Now that there's so much more global use of languages, right? Opportunities to connect, like we talked about, with like filmmakers and other people in the community through Zoom. And, you know, just I think there's so much potential out there. But as we have
things, I think that, like, real quick, one point, just one add on to that, Dana, that you just made me think about is every language teacher, every year at parent teacher conferences, has multiple conversations with a parent who's saying, I wish I would have learned a language. I wish I would have paid better attention. And, you know, the later you get in your career, the closer you get to having the children of your students. And, you know, that is just a nightmare scenario for me, right? That I'm going to be, you know, at a parent teacher conference with somebody who was one of my students who's saying, I really wish I would have liked Spanish when I was, I really wish I would have had a teacher who helped me learn it, you know, and that's me all of a sudden. Right. And so there's a huge responsibility that comes from this.
Yeah. That's true. Right. It's just, it's a connections with students, and it's like bringing that language alive. Right. And having them really wanting to continue in the language, and, you know, seeing the opportunities that will open with that language. Well, yeah. Out of everything we talked about today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
Oh, that is such a great question. I guess really, you know, just when you're the part, you know, given the theme of your podcast about being in the trenches, yeah, and, you know, that is dire as it can feel, and helpless, and, you know, just not good, I guess, is that there's opportunity there for reflection.
Yeah.
And that hopefully this is a moment that will pass, and you'll get to the other side. And in that experience, you know, did you take advantage of this really bad experience to at least find, you know, the learning that can come from it, so that you can continue to grow and get better, and, you know, be better for yourself, be better for your learners and your overall learning community as a result of, you know, having had to experience the going through the trenches.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great reflection on my podcast title. Well, where can people connect with you and find you online?
You know, I'd say the easiest place is on Twitter. That's where I spend most of my time. Not really great at responsiveness on too much else. Even my wife will direct message me, mm-hmm, on Twitter if it's something that's where she's trying to get my attention. But, and I'm at Senor G, S-E-N-O-R-G on Twitter. I also blog a lot at medium.com. And, you know, I'm very easy to get a hold of. You know, if you just Google, I'm pretty easy to find. And, you know, if you reach out to me and I don't respond within 24 hours, you know, you don't ever hesitate to just poke and say, hey, did you get my last message? Or bumping myself up to the top of your inbox, and I'll get back with you, I promise.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the Out of the Trenches podcast. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.